Many, many books have been written about World Wars I and II, and many more movies and TV shows made. The first few years of the History Channel on cable looked like a replay of World War II. Into this mother load of World War analysis steps today's guest, Sir Ian Kershaw, with a new book called To Hell and Back, Europe 1914-1949. This book is part of the Penguin History of Europe series and is the eighth in the series, the final one covering 1950 to the present, planned also by Sir Ian Kershaw. Dr. Kershaw is a British historian of 20th century Germany and has written a number of books on the subject, including large biographies of Adolf Hitler. Sir Ian was knighted in 2002. Sir Ian Kershaw, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It's very nice to be with you.
I understand your analysis of Hitler began with a trip to Germany in the early 70s. What's the story there?
When I went to Germany in 1972 for the first time, I went to attend an intensive language course at an organization called the Goethe Institute, just outside Munich. And I was, at the time, a medievalist. I was working on medieval history and had written one or two things on medieval history. I had a position in that area in my university at Manchester. And while I was there in Munich, I made the decision, really, to move to modern history. And I was intrigued by what went on in the small town just outside Munich where I was staying for a couple of months. And during that visit to Germany, as I said, my first, I had a chance encounter with an old Nazi. I was sitting in a cafe in Munich one rainy Sunday afternoon, minding my own business, really, and I just ended up talking to this man who wanted to know, not surprisingly, what an Englishman was doing in this small town. And I explained to him, and then he went on. Just said, well, you English, you were so stupid in the war. You could have come in the war with us, and between us, we would have divided up the world, and we would have destroyed Bolshevism. And I was, by this time, of course, completely taken with this man and with his what he was saying about the Nazi era. And at one point, I remember the words exactly that he said. We were speaking German, of course, and he said, Der Jude ist eine Laus. The Jew is a louse. And this was the first time that I'd ever heard anything like that, and I was completely shocked by it. But it made me intrigued to find out what went on in this place, what was then under 30 years earlier. And so I made the decision to move to modern history, and soon I found myself actually looking at police reports for this very same place in the 1930s.
Wow, that's a really quite interesting perspective that you got from somebody, and very, very unexpected by the sounds of it, too.
Completely.
How daunting a task was this particular book, To Hell and Back, especially with so much written already?
I found this, I said so in the preface, I found this the most difficult book of any that I have attempted. And that was, as you said, because of the libraries of works that have been written on practically every aspect that you can contemplate. And although I was a specialist on Germany, there were many areas of European history on which my knowledge was fairly scant. But so I had to read an awful lot on lots of different parts of Europe and areas that I was unfamiliar with. And the real difficulties, however, come when you start to write and start to conceive of the architecture of a book like this. How should you put it together? How should you write it? And how should the various parts of Europe be involved in this? Obviously, it can't be simply a sum total of national history. So you have to look for thematic arrangements to take you through the book. But on the other hand, this is a very dramatic half a century in European and, for that matter, world history. And therefore, to do it in pure thematic fashion would actually, to my mind, really dent the drama of the story. And hence, it has to be a blend of the driving dynamic of the narrative, but then interspersed with lots of aspects which can hardly fit into a narrative, but have to be dealt with just the same. So it was a very, very difficult book to construct. That was the main difficulty, I think, in writing it.
Was it a natural choice to extend this volume slightly beyond the end of World War II itself?
I deliberated that, and the natural ending point would have been 1945, as you're intimating. But when I was doing the writing, and when I came to the end of the Second World War, I thought, well, you can play this either way, but the period between 1945 and 1949 is in any way then transitional. It's either the the end of what had been or the beginning of what was to come. And I chose to make it the end of what had been, a point where if you look at Europe in 1945 and 1946, it's still an incredibly violent and chaotic place. By 1949, enormous changes are already taking place. The Cold War is now being established, effectively. The economic recovery, astonishing economic recovery, when you look at Europe in 1945, the economic recovery is already beginning, and as by 1950, it's all well established. And so, in all sorts of ways, you can see this period as a period where crucial developments are taking place in Europe, which then set the scene for a completely changed continent from 1950 onwards, and that's where my second volume will begin.
And you point out, Sir Ian, that Europe was stable for, relatively stable, for nearly 100 years after Napoleon. What began the rise of one of the key trends, the rise of ethnic and racist nationalism?
Well, for racist and ethnic nationalism, you look really essentially to the development of the nation states of Europe in the last third or so of the 19th century, and the area of the Balkans was the where, of course, the First World War was unleashed. The area of the Balkans was the in southeastern Europe was the area where there was the greatest ethnic and racist tension at that time. But there were racial ideas that were spreading across the whole of Europe. And if you look at, for example, the Russian Empire, then already you're dealing with very violent, massive racial pogroms against Jews in this period. And therefore, you're seeing this.
Let's go ahead and take a break there. I'm sorry. We'll come back and talk more to Sir Ian Kershaw about his latest book, To Hell and Back, Europe 1914 to 1949. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Ian Kershaw and you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the British historian Sir Ian Kershaw, who's written a book in the Penguin History of Europe series called To Hell and Back, Europe 1914 to 1949. A single book. He somehow manages to cram it all in less than 500 pages of narrative, and quite effectively. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this period in history, including both world wars and a little bit of time afterward as well. 800-838-3760, the phone number, the email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Sir Ian, we were talking about the rise of ethnic and racist nationalism. You talked about the rise of nation states because they were no longer under empire control or because they were forming up as larger groups from small duchies and things.
The identities within these larger empires were developing, and the ethnic identities of the groups that would come after the First World War to form the nation states were already there and were already in rivalries with other embryonic nation states. So these are within empires. So Europe at this time was still largely a continent of major empires, the German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, and in the southeast, the Ottoman Empire. These empires were on the verge of breaking up. They were facing all sorts of internal problems and tensions and rivalries, and within those then the ethnic tensions were playing a major part. And part of those ethnic tensions was then the anti-Semitism, which had now taken on a outrightly biological racist form and was spreading across much of the European continent.
Which is really good to know. And in fact, this is the same period in which eugenics was at its peak, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Eugenics was part of this, again, part of the same type of pseudo-scientific developments in the late 19th century, which then, in particular after the First World War, took upon greater importance as some of the European countries had lost what they regard as the flower of their men in the terrible killing in the First World War. And so after that, then, countries like Germany, France, but other countries too in Europe, Britain amongst them, became very concerned about the sort of racial stock of their people and how to improve that people, and they're very worried about declining birth rates. And so eugenics, then, the notion of sort of scientific planning of populations, then becomes a very significant development.
Well, and some notable names, as you point out, embraced the concepts of eugenics. Who were some of the people who pushed this as more than pseudoscience?
Well, they were, and some of them, for example, the greatest economist, liberal economist, John Maynard Keynes, was one who backed these sort of ideas, because although later on they come to have a very malign connotation, naturally enough, and we look at the horrors of the Nazi euthanasia program between 1939 and 1941, and the killing of 100,000 or more people who were mentally ill and mentally sick, and all sorts of others as well. And we think of that then in terms of something that's so horrible that how could anybody support it? But in the period immediately after the First World War and throughout the 1920s and into the 30s, in fact, people such as Keynes and many others as well, some of them on the left, not all on the right by any means, looked upon these things as a way of improving your population and of creating a scientifically balanced type of society. And therefore, these ideas were seen initially in a positive way in many parts of Europe, and for that matter, I think I'm right in saying, to also in the United States. So initially, they weren't regarded in the negative way, which, of course, subsequently they came to be quite correctly to be seen.
Well, and it seems like when you combine ethnic divisions and mistrust at its best, I suppose, and certainly can get a lot worse than that, then you combine it with economic downturns, it seems like these always exacerbate each other.
No, that's absolutely the case. And people, when there's an economic downturn of the severity that took place in Europe between the wars, and quite especially in the 1930s, then people look for scapegoats. And it's easy to find scapegoats then in ethnic minorities, in groups such as the Jews, who were then singled out more or less everywhere as scapegoats for the ills that were befalling the majority of the population. And by the time we're into the 1930s, of course, you're having right-wing movements in most European countries, each of which makes great play of racial discrimination, not just the Nazis in Germany. And these movements, fascist and Nazi-style movements, are then singling out Jews, usually, for special treatment under this type of discriminatory set of policies that they have in mind. So racism is spreading, and it's greatly exacerbated by the economic downturn, as you're saying.
Ian Kershaw is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book in the Penguin History of Europe series is called To Hell and Back, Europe 1914 to 1949. You mentioned a lot about class tension here. And so at the dawn of the First World War, how unevenly was wealth distributed across Europe?
Oh, extraordinarily uneven. I haven't got the figures in my head now, but the wealthiest 1% of the population in practically every country controlled a massive proportion of the resources of the wealth. So the wealthiest 1% owned practically all the land. They owned most of the industrial plants that was created. So you're talking about a massive disparity of wealth, huge inequalities of wealth, with a massive proletariat, industrial proletariat, but also a peasantry. We have to remember that much of Europe was still populated by peasants, really. It was only Britain and Belgium, parts of Sweden and parts of Switzerland were well-developed economically, parts of Germany too, of course, were well-developed industrially. Much of the continent, especially in its eastern and southern parts, was agrarian still. So you have a very big agrarian proletariat as well, and it's actually in these areas that you see the roots of fascism, where popular politics are able to scapegoat Jews, as we're saying, and other ethnic minorities, and really exploit then the anger and resentment of the peasants of the farming population in these areas, and create mass movements in a way which hadn't been seen before the First World War.
In essence, saying we, and it's a very narrowly defined we, would be much better off if it weren't for them, whoever the them is.
Yes, there's always that, so a sense of a majority population, which then defined itself often by resort to discrimination, or defining an ethnic minority and then discriminating against it. That's, of course, something which has happened not just in Europe in this period, but in many other times of history as well.
Now, so coming up to World War One, you single out Germany, certainly. What was the German state's main grievance in 1914?
Well, I think about Germany, but in fact, all of the major powers had some part of the blame for the First World War. The great power rivalry was essentially what caused it, and the fear of each of the great powers of other great powers. Germany's position was that it, was a new nation. It had only existed since 1871. It had made very rapid industrial economic progress before the First World War. But it was a country which was very fearful of its future. It feared attacks from the Russians in the east. It feared a war was coming, and it wanted to have what the one German statesman in the early 20th century called its place in the sun. It hadn't got a major overseas empire, so it looked to parts of Europe really for much of its future wealth and to anchor its prosperity, to ensure that the future would be one which would benefit a great nation. It had a great power status, but it wanted to be seen as a singularly important great power. And the great fear was that the Russians, who were rearming very rapidly this time, that the Russians would be a threat to this, and they feared the German military leadership feared an attack from the Russians, and that was therefore what, in a sense, was driving the Germans and the German military leadership to think that if there had to be a war, then probably now was better than a few years' time.
Sir Ian Kershaw is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, British historian, the author of To Hell and Back, Europe, 1914 to 1949, the latest chapter or the latest book in the Penguin History of Europe series. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the period, including both wars and slightly after the second one. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The word terrorism is used in here, Ian. What had been going on within some of these countries leading up to the war?
Leading up to the First World War?
Yes.
In what way? What do you mean inside of the countries?
There had been acts of terrorism against the leadership in some of these countries, hadn't there?
Oh, there have been various assassination attempts. Oh, sorry, I didn't quite understand what you meant. Yeah, there have been certain assassination attempts that have been made against leaders. So it's not just a very modern phenomenon now, but there were attempts to kill, and some of them were successful, to kill a number of leaders of these great states in Europe before the First World War. And of course it was one of these assassination attempts in June 1914 that when the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria was assassinated in Sarajevo in Bosnia, that actually triggered then the spiral of events that would culminate in the outbreak of the First World War.
It's not logical, I would think, to assume, though, that without this assassination, there would have been no world war. It sounds like all the conditions were there.
All the conditions were there. It wouldn't, of course, necessarily have broken out in August 1914. But if you'd been a betting man around that time, you wouldn't have wanted to wager too much money on avoiding a war over the next decade or so. So it looked like things were brewing up to a big showdown in Europe. And the assassination of Franz Ferdinand was the trigger that then brought the event to a head.
Let us bring in a call here from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, Oregon. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ian Kershaw.
Good morning. It's a fascinating subject, and it has so many facets that I have to just decide where to start or where to limit. I mean, on the one hand, there is the armament industry, the Hirtenberger, Austrian, German defense industry. They had a huge investment in all of this. But what interests me more is for the person today, living today in the place that we live in, which happens to be Oregon, how can we relate to what people experienced before and between the wars, and how does it relate to the dangers that we face, like history repeating itself, And how can we, for instance, the fact that the way we look at this history is one thing, because we have airplanes, we have television, we have internet. The circumference of what of people's experience before the First World War was 60 kilometers, if you're lucky, or maybe unlucky. Their experience, their sphere of information and interacting was a lot smaller. And how now are we in a similarly feudal or neo-feudal system today? Because the 99%, we got them. We had them then. We had wage slavery. We had the peasants then.
Mm-hmm.
We need to look at the parallels.
All right, so are the conditions similar, I guess, is what we get down to here. Thanks for that, Wolfgang. Appreciate it. Ian?
Well, of course, the conditions that we're experiencing right at the present, and quite particularly so in Europe, do necessarily cause us to reflect back on the 100 years that's gone by since that time, look back upon the period, which I'll be writing about in the second volume, of course, between the period of the Cold War, and the period of immediately afterwards, when it looked as if Europe was going to be a united continent, and where there was a strong sense of euphoria that this malign past was now behind the continent. And then we see what's happening around us today, and it's a cause for, of course, grave concern that we are seeing now after in this period where the boundaries inside Europe were broken down. We see the boundaries being, the borders being put up back up again. We see the nationalism and to some extent racism on the rise again. So I think what we're seeing at the present time reminds us very much of the conditions of Europe between the wars and in the period of great turmoil, where you have rivalries, tensions, conflicts, and where you have not least then the question of the of nationalism and racism rearing its head again. So it's a time to worry, and it's a time which then makes the history of that very, what seems at one stage a very distant past, seem very present again for us.
Ian Kershaw, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is To Hell and Back, Europe 1914-1949. You quote several notables in the period leading up to the First World War, including the British Foreign Secretary, who just make it sound like it was an inevitable sort of thing. I mean, how great were the efforts to not have war?
Well, the efforts not to have war were obviously not as intense as they should have been, and they were not as great as the readiness to go to war. So every country in a way, well, not every country actually, but some of the countries, notably Britain and France, were looking to avoid war. But every country had, apart from probably Britain, which with its great economic benefits from the global economy, didn't really have anything to gain from another war. But most of the other countries were looking then, for one way and another, to a quick war which would solve their problems. So it was a time where efforts were made, especially in the frenetic last few days before the outbreak of the war, efforts were made to try to prevent it. But these efforts were never going to be sufficient, because many countries had a vested interest in going to war, and the readiness to go to war outweighed the readiness to fight for peace.
And, you know, yet once the war started, it was pretty clear that this was not going to be like recent wars, like the Russo-Japanese War that was over in fewer than 2 years. But the casualties mounted quickly. It doesn't sound like the revulsion led to any serious efforts to bring about peace, though.
I think once people were into war, the war was predicated in every country upon a quick outcome, a quick victory, and there was no plan B. So that once they were in the war, and the casualties, as you said, mounted stratospherically in these first weeks, so that the death rate in the first months was actually the highest in the entire war. But each country then got a vested interest in winning, and therefore none of the countries was prepared to retreat and say, well, we've lost all these men, so we will nonetheless now sue for peace and back out. Prestige, national prestige, was such that they, each of them felt, we've invested in this war, we now have to follow it through to its conclusion. And the basis at the time there was it was men against machines. But the notion was that the greater attritional rate, the country with the greater attritional rate would lose. And hence, each country was prepared to sacrifice tens of thousands, actually in the end, of course, millions of men for the to pull off the ultimate victory. And it took 4 long years before victory was in sight.
You portray Germany as a military dictatorship by the time the war was over. Who had assumed greater powers than the government there?
By 1916, power in Germany had really moved into the hands of the military leadership. The military leadership of Hindenburg and Ludendorff. And those two men, those two generals, effectively controlled Germany in the last 2 years.
Much more to talk about with Sir Ian Kershaw. The book is To Hell and Back, Europe 1914 to 1949, part of the Penguin History of Europe series, for which Ian is working on the next volume as well. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange and talk about both world wars and the period between. And we'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Sir Ian Kershaw and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sir Ian Kershaw, British historian and the author of a book about Europe in World Wars I and II, the period between and slightly after, called To Hell and Back, Europe 1914 to 1949. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this fascinating and highly deadly for many people period in human history. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Talk primarily about the lead up to the First World War and some of the issues that went on during it. At the end of the war, with a couple of empires, the Ottoman and Austro-Hungarian Empire gone, it sounds like there was a fairly good array of wobbly small countries. How big a factor was that in the conditions that led up to the Second World War?
It was an important factor because these countries were founded out of the ruins of these empires, as you just mentioned. And each of these new countries was set up as a democracy. That was the insistence of the people who were involved in the settlement at the end of the First War in Versailles in 1919. And above all, it was on the insistence of the U.S. president at the time, President Wilson. Attempt was made then to set up democracies. But these democracies were set up on very infertile ground. And within a very short time, several of them were already floundering, and the tensions within them had intensified. And these tensions would then increase. And I'm speaking in particular now of Central and Eastern Europe, the area where the tensions were worst, the areas which would turn into the center ground of the killing of the Second World War. And in these areas, each country, as it was set up, each new democracy, despite the notion that there would be self-determination for the peoples of Europe, which was laid down at in the post-First World War settlement, this notion of self-determination was, of course, an impossibility in any ethnic sense, because each country, each of the new nation states, had very big minorities within it, and these tensions there were mixed up then also with border conflicts. And the distinction, the question about where the borders of some of these states should lie. So what you've got is an ethnic mix, border conflicts, racial conflict, and also class conflicts. Now related also since the First World War to the question of Bolshevism now in Russia, the threat that many of these countries saw posed by Bolshevism. Put all that together, and then add on to it the crisis of capitalism that we've been referring to, and you have then all the ingredients for a major blow-up, which, of course, then eventually took place in the 1930s. And of all these countries, the one which was the most centrally important, and the one where each of these conflict areas had its most extreme expression, was Germany. And after 1933, once Hitler took power in Germany, the chances of another war in Europe were shortened immensely.
The combination of ethnic and nationalist tensions with economic situation, how much of Germany in particular, its economic hardship was caused by the punitive set of conditions placed upon it by the Treaty of Versailles?
Versailles, in strictly economic terms, could have been managed. Practically all economic historians agree on that, that in purely economic terms, although it was harmful, the problem could have been managed. Germany's economy by the middle of the 1920s had recovered very strongly. But what was really the problem was not so much economic as political. Germany had lost territory in the Versailles settlement. Its economic potential had been downgraded to some extent, but as I said, that could have been recovered quite well. But there was practically every sector of German society felt deep resentment at the way in which Germany had been treated in the Versailles settlement, and quite especially the fact that Germany had been blamed for the First World War more in its entirety. So the Versailles settlement blamed Germany for the war, which allowed then the Allies to demand reparations, payment for all the damage that Germany had caused in the First World War. And this reparations issue was like a cancer, that it sort of would go into recession for a while and then come back again with another strong attack on the body politic in Germany. And so it never went away. And once he took power in 1933, Hitler himself was able to make great play upon getting rid of the shackles of Versailles and to gain the support not of it just of Nazis and of his own party supporters, but a very great sector of the German population through trying to remove this stain of Versailles, the humiliation felt by Versailles on the German people.
You know, and it needs to be brought up again that Hitler was voted into power. But, you know, it's interesting to think about the electorate in these countries that were, quote, even the ones that were considered democratic at the time. I was surprised at some of the issues you bring up in the book about who made up the voting populace in some of these countries. It was still a very narrow slice of mostly landholding men, wasn't it?
Yes, but after the First World War, practically every country had greatly extended its franchise, extended the numbers of people who were entitled to vote, and in most countries had extended the vote now to women, although in the case of France, that the vote for women wasn't accepted until after the Second World War. But there was a big extension of the franchise, and quite a rapid one after World War One, and this meant, of course, now that lots of new sects of the population were open to persuasion, manipulation by the mass media, manipulation by new populist political parties, including fascist and Nazi-style parties. And many of these groups, therefore, became swept into the maelstrom of support that brought Mussolini in Italy and then later on Hitler in Germany into power. So it is very interesting, as you say, to actually look at the voter potential and the way in which these new types of political parties, fascist parties, were able to mobilize many new voters.
We're talking to Ian Kershaw on the Jefferson Exchange about his book, To Hell and Back, Europe, 1914-1949. You just mentioned mass media. I was coming at it from a different angle when I wrote the question down, but it was about the flowering of culture. But I think what you just reminded us is that you not only get the flowering of culture and distribution of good ideas, you also get a broader dissemination of bad ideas.
No, that's absolutely right. And, of course, as you were probably hinting with your allusion to culture there, the two things went hand in hand. So if you take Germany as the example again here, now you see that in Germany in the 1920s, the new democracy produced a flowering of culture, of cultural experimentation in practically all fields, which went to the extremes that it provoked an extreme reaction from those sectors of the population which actually hated this type of new modern art and modern literature and so on. And they could easily be swept into the path of the Nazis, who then also blamed this what they call the sort of undermining of genuine German culture, the defamation of true culture. They blamed that too on the Jews and came up with the term relating to the alleged Jewish domination of the mass media, of asphalt culture, this notion of it being a sort of city urban culture distinguishable from the pure rural culture of proper Germans. And so even there, in the cultural sphere too, the extremes when were taken then into a racist sense of blaming that too on the Jews.
So there again, the intimation that the people who live in the heartland away from the big cities are the real people of the country.
Yeah.
All right, another call here from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ian Kershaw, the author of To Hell and Back.
Thank you. Charles Lindbergh, he had a little bit of a dark side. I want you to just tell us a little bit about that. He was, between the two wars, I believe he was identified kind of as a Nazi sympathizer, and he also said some horrible things about the Jews.
He was certainly an isolationist.
With that.
All right, thanks for that,
yeah,
John.
Lindbergh.
All right, thanks for that. Charles Lindbergh, not mentioned as I noticed in the book, but certainly a factor in America's readiness for war.
Yes, certainly. I mean, the book is a book about Europe, and therefore many things and many people fall outside the purview of the book, Lindbergh being one of them. But of course, as your listener was commenting there, Lindbergh had sympathies with the right and sympathies with much that was going on in Germany, and I think that's fairly well established.
So when things began to turn south economically, the worldwide Great Depression, as you point out, it's still a bit of argument among economists about what caused it and what the major factors were.
Yes, there is, but I think most of them would agree that the speculative boom in the USA really prompted then the downward spiral of the entire economies of Europe, which were in many ways already dependent upon what was going on in the USA, and the Wall Street crash then which came from the speculative boom then spilled over by the following year into Europe and brought down European banks, and much as we saw in 2008, I think, in another parallel with what went on before, but you saw then European economies plunged into incredible disarray, and unlike 2008-09, there was no international organizations really to help them out of this disarray, so the nationalist rivalries then took place also on the economic level too, and the economic nationalism then really exacerbated the racial tensions, the nationalist conflicts, and so on and so forth. And you had Europe then plunged within a very short time into complete economic but also political turmoil, Germany being the paradigm example there, where you have not just an economic crisis, but a social crisis, a crisis of the state, and also a cultural crisis. So it all boils down to one immense comprehensive crisis. Just to take the opposite example for a second, in my country, in Britain, you have an economic crisis, you have a governmental crisis, but there is no crisis of the state, no crisis of culture. So Britain survives that economic downturn pretty well okay at the political level. Germany collapses politically, and the result is then to let in Hitler.
Well, and one of the other factors that existed in the run-up to the Second World War that didn't exist in the days before the First was that you now have the Soviet Union in place with this workers' paradise, as it's telling the world anyway. How attractive was that to people who really were disaffected and disjointed and dislocated by the economic system as it collapsed around them in Europe?
Well, it was very attractive as an alternative model. After all, in these 2 decades, practically 2 decades of calamitous economic failure, we had a double crisis of capitalism, really, a crisis in the early 1920s of rip-roaring inflation going into hyperinflation where money overnight becomes worthless. And after a very short period of recovery, 4 years until the Wall Street crash, leading in then to the terrible depression, which impoverished many sectors of European society. And in this period, then, all sorts of parts of the population of these countries, impoverished peasantry, but also industrial workers, looked to the Soviet Union, which seemed to be offering a completely new way forward, a way forward without capitalism, and a way forward which is offering a better life for people. Of course, we're well aware now of all the horrors that entailed. But at the time, many people here looked to the Soviet Union as a salvation, as a savior in there from their need, from their distress. And also you find that with intellectuals, too, that many intellectuals in Europe looked to this period. They hadn't very much to be, there wasn't very much in the favor for them of the existing struggling democratic systems. Most of them couldn't, of course, stand fascism. So a lot of them actually looked to Soviet communism as being the way forward, and they were prepared to pull the blinkers over their own eyes sometimes in order to favor that system.
In the handling of the crash in Germany, were there things that the government did that made things worse, if not actually better?
Yes. What they tried to do was to go in for a rigorous balancing of the budget in Germany in the early 1930s, rigorous financial orthodoxy, which we know after the Second World War, for example, that states then were prepared to engage in what was called deficit financing to increase the indebtedness in order to help the economies to recover. That wasn't in vogue in the early 1930s still, so states looked to balance the budget. And in so doing, then created still further economic distress and further depression by forcing more and more people out of work. And Germany did this in the early 1930s and hence played into the hands of the Nazis in a way by only coming up very belatedly with some work creation programs and actually insisting upon this very orthodox way out of it, which just plunged the country from one crisis to another.
Well, obviously we weren't going to get the entire 35-year period discussed in 1 hour, but we got a good bite on it. And I want to thank Ian Kershaw for joining us to talk about his book, To Hell and Back, Europe 1914 to 1949. Well done, and thank you for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. Right, thank you.
Care.